Gorton's personal check. I learned later that it was a mistake that I got paid in check because there was supposed to be no records kept. I got the impression from Gorton that there were a couple of others elsewhere doing the same work. And Gorton said there was someone higher up who knew. I was supposed to go to the convention in Miami to do the same thing there with radical groups.
Why didn't you go? Woodward asked.
My job was terminated 2 days after the Watergate bugging broke. Gorton took me to lunch and said I had to stop because of Watergate. He said the operation was to be considered super secret. People at the White House were upset, said Brill, neatly undercutting the CRP White House contention that nobody in either place had divined a relationship between Watergate and other spying and sabotage. Did Brill have any thoughts about the ethics of his work?
Ethics?
Brill repeated. He sounded astonished at the question.
Well, not illegal, but maybe a little unethical.
Woodward, feeling a bit too pious, thanked him and hung up. He found George Gorton's home number and called. Rock music was blaring in the background, and a young man's voice said Gorton was out. After Woodward returned home, he tried again. It was nearly 1 a.m. More rock music. Gorton came to the phone, and Woodward explained the story.
Are you crazy? Gorton shouted. No Post reporter would call at 1 a.m.
Woodward felt slightly wounded. Why didn't people ever say that to Bernstein when he called at all hours of the morning? Woodward spelled his name and gave Gorton his home and office phone numbers.
We'll see, Gorton shouted. I got a date here.
He slammed down the phone. Woodward sat at his desk looking out the ninth floor window at the lights of the capital city. Creepsters, Nicholas von Hoffman, the Post's iconoclastic columnist, had called them. He stared out the window until he felt his anger subside. The next morning, he was awakened by the phone ringing.
George Gorton, the voice said. I just couldn't believe it was you calling in the middle of the night.
Woodward asked him some questions.
Oh, yeah. Ted Brill did a little work for me. Spying is a funny way to put it. My direction to Bill was only to find out what radicals were doing. It was part of my job to know what all of youth was thinking.
That, said Woodward, was a quaint way to conduct sociological research, planting an undercover agent, essentially an agent provocateur. Gorton denied that Brill had helped arrange the raid on the Quakers, and insisted that Brill's termination had coincidentally occurred 2 days after the Watergate break-in. Then Gorton, who had been director of the youth ball for the president's inaugural, declared proudly that he had people gathering information on radicals in 38 states.
It was my idea,
Gorton said, not too convincingly. He had reported to Kenneth Reitz, director of CRP's Youth Vote Division.
Reitz knew that I could supply him with information on what radicals were thinking. I supplied the information, but Reitz didn't ask where I got it.
Then he changed the story, claiming that Brill had been his lone operative. Ken Reitz, 32, was Haldeman's choice as the next Republican national chairman. He had left CRP for the National Committee to head the 1974 Republican congressional campaigns. Brill's $150 weekly salary hadn't been reported under the new campaign disclosure law. After the Brill story appeared, the General Accounting Office audited the CRP books again. The audit helped establish that Reitz had headed a kiddie corps of young spies for the president. Around this time, Woodward went to visit a well-placed CRP official. The man seemed disaffected, disgusted with the White House and the tactics that had been used to re-elect the president.
If there was an honest and a dishonest way to do something, he said, and if both ways would get the same results, we picked the dishonest way. Now tell me why anyone would do that.
For instance, it's hard to think of specifics, the CRP man said. He thought for another moment. Remember the decision to mine Haiphong about 5 months before the election? Some of us felt that that decision could make or break the president. We spent $8,400 on false telegrams and ads to stir up phony support for the president's decision. Money was used to pay for telegrams to the White House, to tell the president what a great move it was, so that Ziegler could announce that the telegram support was running some large percentage in support of the president. Money also went to pay for a phony ad in the New York Times. He took a copy of the ad out of his desk and handed it to Woodward. Headlined, "The People versus the New York Times," the advertisement criticized a Times editorial that had opposed the mining. "Notice," the man from CRP said, "it's signed by about 10 supposedly independent people, leaving the impression that citizens are up in arms about the editorial and are willing to fork over several $1,000s of their own money to express their opinion. Not so. The ad was paid for by CRP with 40 of those $100 bills from the pile in Stanza's safe." A line in the advertisement ran, "Who can you believe, the New York Times or the American people?" Back at the office, Woodward called another CRP official. He said the attempt to drum up support for the Haiphong decision put the entire staff in overdrive for 2 weeks. The work included petition drives, organizing rallies, bringing the people in buses to Washington, organizing calls to the White House, getting voters to call their congressmen. Bernstein remembered something that tied in. In May 1972, Barker and Sturgis had appeared uninvited at a meeting of Cuban exiles in Miami and attempted to take over plans for organizing a demonstration in support of the mining. Sturgis had driven the lead truck in a parade of support that followed. Sussman told the reporters to write a story on the campaign of deception surrounding the Haiphong issue. "This hits home," he said. "People understand attempts to tamper with public opinion." The day the story ran, James Dooley, a 19-year-old former head of the CRP mailroom, came to the Post newsroom and said he wanted to talk to someone about the Haiphong mining. Woodward took him into Sussman's office. "You don't know everything that was done about Haiphong," said Dooley. "We rigged WTTG's poll on whether the people supported the president's decision." The local Metro Media television station had asked its viewers to send in a card indicating whether they agreed or disagreed with the president on the mining. Sample ballots were placed in advertisements in the Post and the Star. "The press office ran the project," Dooley said, "and work ground to a halt. Everyone had to fill out 15 postcards. 10 people worked for days buying different kinds of stamps and cards and getting different handwriting to fake the responses. Thousands of newspapers were brought from the newsstands, and the ballots were clipped out and mailed in. At a minimum," Dooley said, 4,000 ballots supporting Nixon's decision were sent from CRP. WTTG reported that 5,157 agreed with the president, and 1,158 disagreed. Had the CRP ballots not been sent in, the president would, at best, have lost by one vote— 1,158 to 1,157. "When all the ballots were clipped," Dooley continued, "people became afraid that the newspapers might be discovered. So someone said, 'Shred them.' McCord was in charge of the shredder, and he was upset about a ton of newspapers all over the shredder room. But all the newspapers were destroyed as directed." Woodward called CRP spokesman Devin Shumway and asked if the poll had been rigged. "When you're involved in an election, you do what you can," Shumway replied. "We assumed the other side would do it also. On that assumption, we proceeded. I don't know if the other side did." Woodward asked if the other side Shumway was referring to was the North Vietnamese. "No," Shumway said. "He meant the McGovern forces." Following it down to the end, Woodward called Frank Mankiewicz, McGovern's former campaign aide. "We didn't do it," he said somewhat incredulously. "It didn't occur to us, believe me. These guys are something. They assume we have the same sleazy ethics as theirs." No presidential decision affecting Watergate seemed so ill-advised or left the reporters more perplexed than the White House announcement in February that L. Patrick Gray's name would be submitted to the Senate for confirmation as J. Edgar Hoover's permanent successor. Gray was already the acting FBI director. His confirmation hearings would almost certainly become a congressional inquiry into the FBI's conduct of the Watergate investigation. Why risk the possible consequences of a senatorial fishing expedition to make his tenure permanent? The administration officials to whom the reporters posed the riddle seemed no less baffled. Several insiders professed to know only that there had been a mammoth struggle in the innermost Nixon circle. John Ehrlichman, it was said, had vehemently opposed the nomination, but the president had ultimately rejected his counsel. No one suggested that Gray had been nominated because of ability, or because the White House regarded the hearings as an opportunity to set the Watergate record straight. Shortly before the hearings were to begin, the reporters decided it was time for Woodward to move the flower pot on his balcony. That night he traveled by foot and cab to the garage. Deep Throat wasn't there. Deep Throat had said he would leave a message on a certain ledge when he couldn't make an appointment. Woodward, 5'10", couldn't reach it. He found a section of an old conduit pipe and fished around for it. There was a small piece of paper on which Deep Throat had typed instructions to meet the next night at a bar Woodward had never heard of. A bar? Had Deep Throat gone crazy? Woodward wondered. Something must be wrong. When he got home, he looked the bar up in the phone book. There was no such listing. From a payphone in his apartment building, he dialed information. An operator gave him the listing, an address on the outskirts of the city. At 9 the next night, Woodward walked a few blocks before taking a cab to a section of the city in the opposite direction from the bar. He walked another 15 minutes and took a cab to within a few blocks of the bar. It was really a tavern, an old wooden house, which had been converted into a saloon for truckers and construction workers. Woodward, who was dressed casually, walked in. No one seemed to pay any attention to him. He spotted Deep Throat sitting alone at a side table and nervously sat down across from him. "Why here?" he asked. "A change," Deep Throat said. "None of my friends, none of your friends, would come here. Just a sleepy, dark bar." A waiter came over. They both ordered scotch. "There has to be more to this new meeting place," Woodward said. "A little bit classier surroundings," Deep Throat answered. "No chance you were followed? Two cabs and all?" Woodward nodded. "How'd the post like its subpoenas?" "Just great," said Woodward. "That's only the first step. Our president has gone on a rampage about news leaks on Watergate. He's told the appropriate people go to any length to stop them. When he says that, he really means business. Internal investigations, plus he wants to use the courts. There was a discussion about whether to go the criminal route or the civil suit route first. At a meeting, Nixon said that the money left over from the campaign, about $5 million or so, might as well be used to take the Washington Post down a notch. Thus your subpoenas and the others. Part of the discussion was about starting a grand jury investigation, but that's for later. Nixon was wild, shouting and hollering that we can't have it and we're going to stop it. I don't care how much it costs. His theory is that the news media have gone way too far and the trend has to be stopped. Almost like he was talking about federal spending. He's fixed on the subject, and doesn't care how much time it takes, he wants it done. To him, the question is no less than the very integrity of government and basic loyalty. He thinks the press is out to get him, and therefore is disloyal. People who talk to the press are even worse, the enemies within, or something like that. Woodward took a breath. Deep Throat sipped his scotch gingerly, then wiped his mouth inelegantly with the back of his hand. How worried was he? Worried? Deep Throat leaned back and threw his arm over his chair. It can't work. They'll never get anyone. They never have. They're hiding things that will come out, and even discredit their war against leaks. The flood is coming, I'm telling you. So the White House wants to eat the Washington Post. So what? It'll be wearing on you, but the end is in sight. It's building, and they see it. And they know that they can't stop the real story from coming out. That's why they're so desperate. Just be careful, yourselves and the paper, and wait them out. Don't jump too fast. Be careful, and don't be too anxious. Woodward was anything but reassured by his friend's assessment. He said he needed more details if he was going to tell the others that the Post, that they were on the menu, but weren't going to be eaten. Deep Throat shook his head, indicating that he could not say much more. "What about Gray's nomination?" asked Woodward. "That didn't make any sense." Deep Throat said that it made all the sense in the world, though it was a big risk. In early February, Gray went to the White House and said, in effect, "I'm taking the rap on Watergate." He got very angry and said he had done his job and contained the investigation judiciously, that it wasn't fair that he was being singled out to take the heat. He implied that all hell could break loose if he wasn't able to stay in the job permanently and keep the lid on. Nixon could have thought this was a threat, though Gray isn't that sort of guy. Whatever the reason, the president agreed in a hurry and sent Gray's name up to the Senate right away. Some of the top people in the White House were dead set against it, but they couldn't talk him out of it. So good Pat Gray had blackmailed the president. "I never said that," Deep Throat laughed. He lifted his eyes, the picture of innocence. Stephen Sachs, the attorney for Gray, told Woodward in early 1974 that the suggestion that Gray had pressured or blackmailed the president was outrageously false. He, Gray, went to the White House expecting not to get the job, Sachs said. Nixon told him that he should be as ruthless as Hoover in stopping leaks and be aggressive in the use of polygraphs, lie detectors. Sachs said that pressuring the White House was not the way Gray handled himself with those guys. It was plain fear most of the time. Now, it makes perfect sense that some of those guys down there would think he might be pressuring because that's the way they operate. But not Gray. Woodward asked Deep Throat, "What about the Time magazine story? Had Gray been aware of taps on reporters and White House aides?" "Affirmative," said Deep Throat, and cautioned that even he didn't know all there was to know about the subject. There was an out-of-channels vigilante squad of wiretappers that did it, including taps on Hedrick Smith and Neil Sheehan of the New York Times, after the Pentagon Papers publication. But it started before that. All the records have supposedly been destroyed. He explained that the wiretapping had been done by ex-FBI and ex-CIA agents, who were hired outside the normal channels. Mardian had run the Justice Department end of the operation for the White House. Watergate was nothing new to the administration, Deep Throat continued. There had been an election strategy session at which Haldeman pushed Mitchell to set up a wiretapping operation for the campaign. Mitchell had been reluctant, but Haldeman was insistent. Mitchell was instructed by the White House chief of staff to move part of the vigilante operation from the White House to the campaign. That meant Hunt and Liddy.
In 1969, the first targets of aggressive wiretapping were the reporters and those in the administration who were suspected of disloyalty, Deep Throat said. Then the emphasis was shifted to the radical political opposition during the anti-war protests. When it got near election time, it was only natural to tap the Democrats. The arrests and the Watergate sent everybody off the edge because the break-in could uncover the whole program. Deep Throat and Woodward each had another scotch, luxuriating in the unfamiliar comfort of their meeting place. Woodward wondered if his friend was intentionally flirting with the danger of being discovered. Did Deep Throat want to get caught, so he would be free to speak publicly? Was there a love-hate dialectic about his government service? Woodward started to ask, then faltered. It was enough to know that Deep Throat would never deal with him falsely. Someday it would be explained.
The drinks were cheap. Woodward put a $5 bill on the table and left first. The next morning, the reporters studied Woodward's notes. They were now thinking in terms of a report which, like the October 10th story on the massive campaign of spying and espionage, would attempt to put Watergate in perspective. Just as the break-in had been but a small part of a massive election-year campaign of espionage and sabotage, the whole undercover effort to re-elect the president was, in its turn, part of a broader program directed by the president's men, almost from the beginning, against those who they thought threatened the administration. But the reporters would need more, details, examples, others who could confirm what had happened. Pat Gray's confirmation hearing was set to begin February 28th. The night before, Bernstein talked to Tom Hart, a young aide to Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia, who was the Senate Democratic whip and a member of the Judiciary Committee. Hart had compiled a card index of the newspaper and magazine stories and, from these, had filled a loose-leaf binder with lists of contradictions and unanswered questions about Watergate. The questions were being circulated to selected members of the committee. Until they were answered, and buttressed by evidence from the FBI's Watergate files, Gray would remain on the witness stand, Hart said. Even if the Judiciary Committee reported out a positive recommendation, Byrd would use his considerable influence to oppose the nomination on the Senate floor if the contradictions were not cleared up. The hearings opened on February 28th, with Gray chewing on throat lozenges and insisting that the Watergate investigation had been a massive special, a full-court press with no holds barred. Then, without being asked, he volunteered that he had turned over the files of the investigation to John Dean, and could not guarantee that Dean hadn't shown them to Donald Segretti. The senators were astonished. Woodward was relieved that Bernstein wasn't there to hear Gray's testimony. He had been maintaining for months that they should write a story on Dean's receipt of the files. Woodward hadn't thought it important, which was exactly what Gray was presently contending, without much success. He was offering to make the FBI's Watergate files available to the senators, but the impression that Pat Gray had acted as valet for John Dean, more than 20 years his junior, had sunk in. The Gray hearings were going to become the Dean hearings as well. That was clear. The next day, Thursday, Bernstein read his file on John Dean. Dean, who had come into possession of the contents of Howard Hunt's safe after June 17th, had waited at least 7 days to turn them over to the FBI. One notation indicated that two notebooks belonging to Hunt had not been listed in Dean's inventory. A Justice Department attorney told Bernstein that the prosecutors had first heard of them on October 11th, when Hunt had filed a motion demanding the return of belongings he had left at his office. "The White House claimed they never saw the notebooks," Bernstein was told. "We didn't know what to think. We still don't." He called Hunt's attorney, William Bittman. Bittman confirmed the story and told Bernstein that the notebooks contained names and addresses which the prosecutors had told him might lead to others involved in the Watergate conspiracy. "We thought the FBI had them and had used them in their investigation. I was going to argue that the government's whole case was tainted, because their information had come from material, the notebooks, obtained in an illegal search. I was going to call Dean and the other people at the White House to show that Hunt was still using his office in June, and that he had not abandoned his property in the White House. When we found the FBI never got the notebooks, the whole issue became moot," Bittman said. "All I can say is that the whole thing was very strange. I don't know where they went." Bernstein asked how useful Hunt thought the notebooks would be in building a case against higher-ups. "I'll let you guess," Bittman said. "Valuable enough for someone to want them to disappear." On Friday, March 2nd, at an impromptu news conference, President Nixon announced that he would claim executive privilege against any demand that Dean testify at the Gray hearings. The story of the missing notebooks and Dean's role in turning over the materials in Hunt's safe ran with an account of the president's remarks. 4 days later, Gray told the senators he was unalterably convinced that Dean had withheld nothing from Howard Hunt's safe. Almost simultaneously, the White House issued a statement asserting that Dean had turned over all its contents. In late 1973, John Dean acknowledged that he had destroyed the notebooks, which he had found the previous January in the president's personal financial file. The White House said the president did not know the notebooks were in his estate file and declined further comment. But the whole matter was eclipsed by a more startling development at the hearings. That afternoon, a group of reporters, including Woodward, filed into Tom Hart's anteroom to pick up copies of documents Gray had supplied in answer to some of the senator's earlier questions. One was headed, "Interview with Herbert W. Kalmbach." Mr. Kalmbach said that in either August or September 1971, he was contacted by Mr. Dwight Chapin and was informed that Captain Donald H. Segretti was about to get out of the military service and that he may be of service to the Republican Party. It was all there. Kalmbach had admitted, in the interview, that he had paid Segretti for undercover activities, on instructions from Chapin. In one irretrievable step, Patrick Gray had undermined the basic claim of White House innocence. In the process, he had helped establish the credibility of the Washington Post. Bernstein and Woodward had difficulty finishing the Gray story by deadline. Newspapers, networks, radio, and television stations were phoning for comments on the Post's vindication. Almost all the callers used that word. Bernstein and Woodward's story reflected 10 months of pent-up anger and frustration. They threw quote after quote of White House denials back at the president's men. But the article was unintentionally packaged like an axe murder. Leading the paper under a three-column head, FBI chief says Nixon's aides paid Segretti. The text was juxtaposed with oversized pictures of Chapin, Kalmbach, and Segretti. The unfortunate combination of their placement running down the side of the page and the captions under the pictures made them look like mugshots sent over from homicide. Chapin reported Segretti available. Kalmbach, just a dispersing agent. Segretti, linked to Nixon staff. In the excitement, the effect went unnoticed at the Post, but not at the White House. The reporters were told by officials there and elsewhere in the administration that the story's treatment had generated as much hatred of the Post as anything. Bradley, usually sensitive to such things, had been too pleased by the day's events to notice. Between calls for interviews, he raced around the office, pounding Rosenfeld on the shoulder, attempting to exchange a jive handshake with Sussman, who almost lost his pipe, and proclaiming that Pat Gray had rescued the Free Press. For the next 2 weeks, the reporters watched in amazement as, day after day, Gray attested to the ineptitude, if not the criminal negligence, of his supervision of the FBI's investigation. Deep Throat's implicit suggestion that Nixon had been frightened into nominating Gray became increasingly plausible as the nominee demonstrated a dangerous candor. On March 22nd, Gray testified that John Dean had probably lied when he told the FBI on June 22nd that he did not know if Howard Hunt had an office in the White House. The White House issued a statement unequivocally denying Gray's charge, and Dean demanded a correction. The day before, CRP's subpoenas of the Post reporters and news executives had been thrown out of court. Chapter 14. The next morning, March 23rd, Woodward was walking down a corridor near the editorial page offices when Herblock, the Post cartoonist, stopped him. "Hey, did you hear about McCord's letter to the judge? I heard it on the radio." The last time somebody had brought him news of Watergate from the radio, Woodward thought, the Haldeman story had blown up. "No, he hadn't heard," he said, and waited. "Yeah, McCord saying there was perjury and pressure to keep quiet, and others are in on it." As Woodward bounded into the newsroom, Howard Simons, standing near the national desk, was waving a piece of wire copy and shouting. It was the text of a letter from McCord to Sirica. Several members of my family have expressed fear for my life if I disclose knowledge of the facts in this matter. In the interests of justice, of restoring faith in the criminal justice system, McCord was coming forward to tell what he knew. Woodward studied the letter's charges. Political pressure had been applied to the defendants to plead guilty and remain silent. Perjury had occurred during the trial. Others involved in Watergate were not identified in testimony. McCord had requested a meeting with Sirica after sentencing. Since I cannot feel confident in talking with an FBI agent, in testifying before a grand jury whose U.S. attorneys work for the Department of Justice, or in talking with other government representatives. Woodward wondered whether McCord could prove his charges. An image of John Mitchell being led off by marshals flashed through his mind. Simons, jubilant, told Woodward, "Find out what the hell he's talking about. Who committed perjury? Who else was involved? Who applied pressure?" He called Mrs. Graham in Singapore. Bradley was subdued. The letter might be a giant step, but it was vague. "Names, fellas. We want names," he said. That Sunday, both reporters were in the office finding out that Howard Simons' directions were more difficult to follow than to state. If McCord had yet told anybody what he had in mind when he unburdened himself, it was a well-kept secret. The prosecutors doubted that McCord knew much. The White House lid was on tight. The few presidential aides who returned calls knew nothing. They called back because they hoped to learn something from the reporters. In mid-afternoon, Woodward was notified that Samuel Dash, the chief counsel of the Senate Watergate Committee, was going to hold a press conference in an hour. Bernstein took a cab to Capitol Hill. Dash was sitting in his office behind a steel-gray desk, waiting for the camera crews to make their final adjustments. Speaking from notes, he said that he had interviewed McCord in two long, tape-recorded sessions over the weekend. McCord had named names and begun supplying a full and honest account of the Watergate operation. Bernstein couldn't understand why Dash was holding a press conference. He wasn't giving concrete details, merely building expectations about whatever it was that McCord had told him. There were going to be public hearings by the Watergate Committee at which McCord would certainly testify. The press could blow the Watergate Committee's investigation out of the water if McCord's charges leaked and could not be proved. He went back to the office and unenthusiastically began to see if he could find a committee source who would say what McCord had said. He had made half a dozen unsuccessful calls when the item moved over the Los Angeles Times wire. McCord had told Dash that Jeb Magruder and John Dean had had advanced knowledge of the Watergate bugging operation and were involved in its planning. The story was by Ron Ostrow and Robert Jackson. Bernstein knew they wouldn't take a flyer unless their source was absolutely reliable. The information about Magruder was no surprise. But there had been no real hint from anyone that Dean had had anything to do with planning the bugging. If the man named by the president to investigate the bugging had been one of its planners, the consequences seemed incalculable. Already the White House had issued a statement denying categorically the charges against Dean. The statement did not mention Magruder. The Nixon men had cut him loose. Simons arrived at the office wearing hiking boots. Since receiving the initial tip on the Watergate break-in on June 17th, he had been the senior editor most involved in the day-to-day progress of the story. By evening, Bernstein had called more than 40 people. Senators, members of the Watergate Committee staff, lawyers, CRP and White House sources, Justice Department officials, friends of McCord, even his minister. Nothing. He and Simons decided he would write a story quoting the Times and noting that the Post had been unable to confirm that McCord had made the allegations. Then Simons got a call from a lawyer who said he represented John Dean. He was threatening to file a libel suit if the Post ran the allegations about Dean. Simons told Bernstein to quote the threat and name the lawyer. Simons sensed Bernstein's frustration at the day's events. He told him to get accustomed to being beaten on stories. The days when the Post had dominated the Watergate story were over. The next morning, Bernstein and Woodward searched frantically for confirmation of the Times account and came up finally with three people on Capitol Hill who said it was correct. One, a Republican politician, said McCord's allegations were convincing, disturbing, and supported by some documentation. At the White House, Ron Ziegler announced that the president had personally telephoned Dean and expressed absolute and total confidence in him. Watergate was going to burst. The McCord allegations were only part of the pressure building against the dam which Deep Throat had talked about. The rush was still distant, but it was streaming closer. Dean, Magruder, Mardian, Mitchell, and, most important, H.R. Haldeman were likely to be swept away in the flood. Woodward decided to ask the deputy press secretary, Gerald Warren, for an interview with the president. It was a long shot, an almost embarrassingly long one, but Woodward had always been struck by Richard Nixon's affinity for the unexpected. If the president could open negotiations with Red China, why not with the Washington Post? Woodward phoned Warren and asked if he could come over for a discussion. Warren hesitated, then said, "Sure." Woodward didn't have a White House press pass. Warren said he would leave Woodward's name at the gate. March 27th was a warm, sunny day, and Woodward worked up a moderate sweat walking the five blocks to the White House. The press lounge on the West Wing was deserted. He waited in a stiff-backed, upholstered chair. After about 10 minutes, Warren came out of a long back hallway and took Woodward to his office. Not much bigger than a dressing closet, it was just large enough for his desk and chair and a chair for a visitor. Warren, tall, bespectacled, and neatly groomed, is rather scholarly in appearance and demeanor. "Do you mind if I take notes?" Warren asked, adjusting the glasses on his nose and flipping to a clean page of his yellow legal-size pad. Of course Woodward didn't object. He explained that he and Bernstein had information indicating that Watergate was a much broader conspiracy than anyone had yet suggested publicly. The information was going to come out, Woodward said, and the Post was not going to be the only agent of disclosure. Perhaps the White House knew of things that might mitigate the effect. The Post wanted to explore those factors. The situation had reached a level of gravity where only direct responses by the president might lessen the damage. Warren occasionally looked up from his notepad and asked for specific facts. Woodward said that he and Bernstein wanted to talk only to the president about the facts, and hoped that Warren would consider this a formal request for an interview. Warren said he would, but that he assumed the request would be denied. "I can tell you," he said, "that it will be a decision I won't make. I'll forward the request up the line." Woodward imagined it would get about as far as Ziegler, whom he had purposely not called. He tried again. Judging from their evaluation of the information, Woodward said, the president was going to have to jump ship on the Watergate at some point soon. The Post was anxious to discuss specifics before that happened. Woodward said they had information about additional wiretaps, break-ins, and other secret operations, all of which was going to come out. Warren winced a little and cast a skeptical glance at him. "If you could be more specific, it would help," he said. Woodward said that he wouldn't go into specific details at that moment, but if the president agreed to be interviewed, then questions would be provided in advance. There would be no attempt to spring something on him. Woodward felt a hideous rush of nervousness. This wasn't working, he realized. Also, his awe of the presidency clutched at him. That was part of the reason he was there, sitting in that closet office, he realized. It was to give warning. Warren, too, realized that. But not a threat, Woodward wanted to make clear. It was, in an odd way, friendly, and meant to convey respect and the possibility of a way out. Woodward was seeking an adjustment. He wanted the paper to persuade by facts and good reporting, but he had no wish to build a hostile wall. Warren smiled as if to say, "It doesn't work that way. You either have the goods and print them, or you don't." But he sounded sympathetic at times, as if he wanted to sweep the papers off his desk and say, "Right, we've got to talk about this." It could have been Woodward's imagination and Warren's gentle ways. When Woodward finished his presentation, Warren laid his pen gently on his pad, stood, and extended his hand. "I'll be back to you," he said. Woodward replied that there was no hurry and shrugged his shoulders to say he knew what the answer would be. As he walked out of the Cracker Box office and into the sun, he felt buoyant. He had tried. Bernstein and he were well aware that they would have far less to do with events than before. Much bigger forces were firmly in charge. Government investigations were underway, and the instinct for survival could turn some of the president's men into informers. On Wednesday, March 28th, McCord was scheduled to give his first sworn testimony behind closed doors to the 7 senators on the Watergate Committee. Bernstein joined dozens of reporters waiting outside the hearing room. The reporters began discussing leaks, which were bound to come out, and agreed on the dangers of trying to report what would go on inside. It was no longer a matter of investigative reporting, evaluating information, putting together pieces in a puzzle, disclosing what had been obscured. They would be merely trying to find out in advance the testimony of witnesses who would eventually take the stand in public. Judging which allegations were hearsay, which first-hand knowledge, and placing them in context would be difficult. Sensational charges and deliberate leaks by interested parties would be hard to evaluate. If some papers or networks searched out leaks, all the reporters would feel bound to compete. The committee session with McCord lasted 4.5 hours. Afterward, Senator Howard Baker of Tennessee, the Republican vice chairman of the committee, announced that McCord had provided significant information, covering a lot of territory. Bernstein and Woodward began the ritual phone calls, starting with the senators. "Okay, I'm going to help you on this one," one told Woodward. McCord testified that Liddy told him the plans and budget for the Watergate operation were approved by Mitchell in February, when he was still attorney general. And he said that Colson knew about Watergate in advance. But in answer to Woodward's questions, he added that McCord had only second-hand information for his allegations, as well as for his earlier accusations that Dean and Magruder had had prior knowledge. However, the senator said, he was very convincing. Bradley was able to get a second senator to corroborate the story, and Bernstein received the same version from a staff member. The next day's story, though calling attention to the hearsay nature of McCord's testimony, quoted the unnamed senator's evaluation. The flood of McCord says stories continued. McCord appeared again on Thursday, and the reporters went through the same exercise. McCord stated that Liddy had told him that charts outlining the Watergate operation had been shown to Mitchell in February. 3 sources gave identical versions of the testimony. At this point, Press Secretary Ronald Ziegler announced that the president sought to dispel the myth that we seek to cover up, had ordered members of his staff to appear before the grand jury and testify, if called. The Star News interpreted this as a change of policy and reported that it appears to be a significant relaxation of Nixon's firm policy of sheltering the staff under the doctrine of executive privilege. Concerned that the Post would make the same error, Bernstein and Woodward went to Dick Harwood, the national editor. Ziegler himself had said there was nothing new in the policy. Several White House aides had already either testified before or given sworn depositions to the grand jury. The president had never asserted a claim to executive privilege on their behalf to protect them from testifying in criminal investigations, but only in congressional hearings. The reporters suggested strongly to Lou Cannon, a post-national staff reporter who was writing the story, that the newest Ziegler announcement did not represent a change of policy. Cannon's Republican sources were considerable, and he had written some of the Post's finest pieces about the effects of Watergate on the White House and the GOP. Now he was furious. He had discussed the matter with the most experienced members of the White House press corps, and they had agreed that the president had relaxed his position on sweeping executive privilege. Watergate had been, for some months, a strain on the never-very-cozy relations between the city and national desks at the Post. Bernstein and Woodward were outraged by the tenor of Cannon's story, and also by its position as the lead in the next day's paper. The next day, their White House sources confirmed that Ziegler's statement was nothing more than a public relations gesture. But the Senate committee and staff now charged, more importantly, that it was intended to divert attention from the president's claim of executive privilege in the Senate investigation. Senate sources suggested an additional reason for the president's willingness to cooperate with one inquiry and not another. The grand jury's proceedings would be secret, and under the supervision of the administration's Justice Department. The Senate hearings would be public and independent of the executive. 9 months after Watergate, the White House demonstrated once again that it knew more about the news business than the news business knew about the White House. If there was one Washington reporter unlikely to be taken in by White House manipulations, Bernstein and Woodward thought it was Seymour Hersh of the New York Times. A mutual friend had arranged for Bernstein and Woodward to have dinner with Hersh on April 8th. Hersh, 36, horn-rimmed and somewhat pudgy, showed up for dinner in old tennis shoes, a frayed, pinstriped shirt that might have been his best in his college freshman year, and rumpled, bleached khakis. He was unlike any reporter they had ever met. He didn't hesitate to call Henry Kissinger a war criminal in public, and was openly attracted and repelled by the power of the New York Times. Hersh had broken the story of the cover-up of My Lai, and had spent years reporting on military and national security bureaucracies. He was uniquely qualified to understand the ramifications of Watergate. "I know these people," Hersh said. "The abiding characteristic of this administration is that it lies." He could be just as tough on the New York Times. "Lies, lies, lies," he remarked of a story written by one of his colleagues. During dinner, Bernstein and Woodward brought up one of the president's men who was under suspicion in Watergate. "I'd really love to get that son of a bitch, too. I know him from way before Watergate," Hersh said. "But he'll get no cheap shots from me. Either I get him hard, with facts, solid information, evidence, the truth, or I don't touch him." The three exchanged their sense of some of the witnesses and principals in Watergate, being careful not to tip their hands. Later that evening, Bernstein joshingly asked Hersh what Watergate story he was going to unload when the Times front page arrived at the Post that night. "Just a little something," Hersh replied. Bernstein and Woodward couldn't tell if he was kidding. Woodward called the office. Hersh wasn't kidding. His little something was the first report that McCord had testified that the cash payoffs to the Watergate conspirators had come directly from CRP. The connection was one of the keys they had all been waiting for. Since January, everyone had assumed that CRP had bought the conspirators' silence, but now someone was finally saying so from the inside. Months earlier, Hugh Sloan had told the reporters that the celebrated secret fund had never ceased to exist, even after the Watergate arrests. Bernstein and Woodward had been astonished. Sloan had told them that the money had been transferred from Stanza's safe to Fred LaRue. They hadn't written about it because they couldn't confirm it and didn't know how the money had been spent. Sloan had refused to say how much money was involved. Now it seemed possible that the money had bought the defendant's silence. LaRue had been John Mitchell's deputy and co-director of Watergate housecleaning. He and Mardian were the two CRP officials who had supervised Kenneth Parkinson and the other committee lawyers. McCord's testimony had identified Parkinson and the late Dorothy Hunt, Howard Hunt's wife, as conduits for the payments to the conspirators. Woodward called a CRP official who had been friendly but unwilling to talk specifics. The man exploded on the phone about the awful state of affairs in the wake of the McCord disclosures. "John Mitchell still sits there smoking on his pipe, not saying much. I used to take that for wisdom, you know, keeping your mouth shut. Now I realize that it's ignorance. God, I never thought I'd be telling you guys that I didn't hate what you did. It's the way the White House has handled this mess that's undermined the presidency.
I got friends who look at me now and say, how can you have any self-respect and still work for CRP? I'm sick.
Seeing an unusual opportunity, Woodward said he and Bernstein knew that LaRue was involved in the payoffs to the conspirators. Woodward had only seen pictures of LaRue. He was a balding little man with round spectacles, a former Las Vegas casino owner and oil millionaire. The perfect bagman, Woodward had thought.
I can't answer any questions, but I'll tell you one thing you might have trouble believing, the man from CRP said. Fred LaRue won't lie under oath. If they ask him, he's going to say he helped pay the men off.
Woodward called Hugh Sloan.
LaRue paid off the boys, Woodward announced, then realized how silly he sounded.
Sloan wasn't surprised to hear it. He had always suspected the worst, whatever it was.
How much money was transferred from the fund?
Woodward was looking for a ballpark figure.
Sloan wouldn't say.
They played their old game, like two sparring partners who hadn't been in the ring for a while.
More than 100,000? More than 50,000? Between 50,000 and 100,000?
Which side of 75,000?
Within five of that, Sloan said.
That was good enough. It was probably 80,000, but they would use 70,000.
How could CRP continue the secret fund after the Watergate arrests and get away with it?
The transfer, was done in July, Sloan said. Nothing had come out about the money yet, and Secretary Stans approved it. It was a way of doing business, having cash around.
Sloan presumed that somebody had told Stans to do it, but he didn't know who. He was assuming the worst on that, too.
Do the prosecutors know about this? Woodward asked.
I don't think so, Sloan said. I was never asked.
Sloan did say, however, that he had been asked the relevant questions about secret cash when he had testified a few weeks previously, before a federal grand jury in New York City that was investigating the cash contributions to CRP by Robert L. Vesco, an international financier and accused swindler. Vesco's gift of $200,000 in $100 bills was delivered to the committee in a black attaché case. It had been added to the cash fund in Stans's safe and had helped finance the Watergate operation and other undercover activities.
Woodward called a Justice Department official.
Were the prosecutors trying to determine if the conspirators were paid off with the $70,000 LaRue got out of Stans's safe after Watergate?
The prosecutors are looking at every penny of committee money to see if it went for payoffs, every penny they can find.
Including the money that was in Stans's safe?
Right.
That tied the knot. The secret fund had brought the reporters full circle. First the bugging, and now the cover-up.
The White House Correspondents' Association annual dinner is a formal, overdone, alcohol-saturated event attended by all those with power or pretensions to power in the media and the government. It was held on April 14th at the Washington Hilton, and Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Kissinger, and the President, who arrived after dinner flanked by a retinue of POWs, were among those who sat through an evening's entertainment that was interspersed with savage Watergate jokes. Bernstein and Woodward had been invited because they had received two journalism awards. They spent a good part of the evening pretending they had never before met administration aides who had been sources for them. Some had always been difficult to reach and reluctant to talk. Now, a number of them were themselves shut out, and wanted the reporters to tell them what was happening.
What's going on? How bad is it? What do you think the president should do? They were asking the reporters.
In the lobby after the dinner, the reporters saw Attorney General Kleindienst holding court. Kleindienst's public statements had been the backbone of the administration's defense of its investigation. Woodward and Bernstein had never had any access to him. They went up to introduce themselves.
You two follow the courage of your convictions, Kleindienst said.
What's going on? Woodward asked.
The Watergate case is going to blow up, Kleindienst said simply. Woodward said they should talk. What about the next day, Sunday?
I have to go to church, said Kleindienst.
Bernstein and Woodward said they were anxious to talk.
Okay, Kleindienst said. You go to church with me tomorrow morning, and afterwards we'll come back to my house and have breakfast.
Some of the news organizations had rented hospitality suites, where drinks were served almost to sunrise. Woodward arrived at the Wall Street Journal's party at about 2 a.m. Some 20 people, glasses in hand, were gathered in one corner, and a familiar voice was ringing out from the center of the circle.
You son of a bitch!
Unmistakably, Bradley. He was arguing with his former employee, now White House aide Ken Clausen. The subject was Clausen's purported statement confessing he had written the Canuck letter. But the argument ranged over ancient battles, the press versus the government, the Washington Post versus Nixon. Clausen had once told friends that Bradley was the man he most admired. Now he despised Bradley, and held him personally to blame for the Canuck letter story. Fueled by alcohol, the debate grew hotter and more personal. The two men, in dinner clothes, waved away anyone who tried to join in. Finally, in a ridiculous attempt to be more discreet, they moved into a closet and left the door open.
"Have they hit each other yet?"
one woman asked, hopefully.
At the bar, there was another Watergate imbroglio. Edward Bennett Williams, the Post's lawyer, and the president of the Washington Redskins, President Nixon's favorite football team, was faced off against Patrick J. Buchanan, a White House speechwriter. Williams's firm also represented the Democratic Party. He was speaking bitterly about the 1972 election.
"You're just a sore loser, Ed," Buchanan was saying.
"But you did it dirty, Pat," Williams said, heaving his large body to one side. "You had to do it dirty. You won, but you had to steal it."
"The Watergate's all you had," Buchanan retorted. "Some Cubans going in to look at Larry O'Brien's mail. You blew it out of all proportion."
"Dirty, Pat. Dirty election," Williams said. "Aren't you ashamed? You're a conservative in all this law-breaking. And the Washington Post really sticking it to you. Oh, that must have hurt the most."
Williams threw his arm around Woodward.
"The Washington Post just jamming it up your old ass."
61%, Ed," Buchanan responded. 61%. Just the biggest landslide in recent history.
And if it hadn't been for Watergate, it would have been more." "You did it dirty."
"A little spying, Ed. That's politics.
I bet you guys had the binoculars on Shula, the Miami Dolphin football coach, at the Super Bowl. You had the glasses out on the other side of the stadium, and you didn't even win."
"You won, Pat, all right. But now everyone is seeing how it stinks."
Williams faltered slightly, clutching his drink in both hands.
"How about some of your clients, Ed?"
Buchanan responded, referring possibly to former Teamster president James Hoffa and ex-Senate aide Bobby Baker.
"You've really handled some fine fellas."
"Pat," Williams said, moving in and planting his bulky frame in front of Buchanan. "I'm surprised at you, Pat. There's one big difference."
"How about some of those crooks you defended?" Buchanan taunted.
"There's a big difference," Williams boomed. "Such a big difference."
He bent his head, leaned against the bar, and looked up quietly.
"What's this big difference, Ed?"
"I didn't run any of my clients for president."
The next morning, Woodward and Bernstein slept through church and drove out to Virginia to Kleindienst's house for the breakfast they had been promised. Mrs. Kleindienst opened the door.
"He's been called to the White House and can't discuss Watergate with you," she said. "He went there for services and had to stay for a meeting. He was sorry."
That Sunday afternoon at dusk, Woodward and a friend were sitting on a grassy ridge in Montrose Park in Georgetown. A short distance away, Woodward saw a couple in intense conversation strolling toward them.
"It's Haldeman," Woodward's friend said.
It was indeed Haldeman, wearing light-colored sneakers, casual slacks, and a tan windbreaker. He walked slowly, his hands in his pockets. His wife, also casually dressed, was speaking to him with obvious emotion and conviction. Haldeman was silent, occasionally turning his head to her. The sun was setting. Woodward saw a chance to get past the wall. Here, in a public park, with no guards or police or White House limousines, waiting.